WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Professor David Ray Griffin.
And yet, for the first time, we are on the verge of a truly global empire, an empire with no borders. Our own country is involved in what Richard Falk and others call the Global Domination Project. And yet, from watching the mainstream media, you would never guess that these catastrophic events were going on. Like the Roman citizens during the Roman Empire, we are entertained and distracted with bread and circuses. So I've been on the road this week, and I'm not quite sure what the story of the week was. I just heard little bits and pieces, but it sounded like the big thing this week was runaway flip-flops kidnapped in the White House or something like that. And with all these things going on, the media doesn't discuss any of them. I'm a Christian theologian, so what I am particularly upset about is they're claiming to do this empire and this destruction of the world in the name of God. As a theologian, I deal with the relation between the divine and the demonic. And if you look at the Abrahamic traditions, or you look at any of the major traditions in the world, there is a large agreement that that which we call holy, that which we call divine, is that which embodies truth, justice, compassion. So if there is such a thing as the demonic, it would be that which is diametrically opposed to that and has power to threaten its very purposes. And so the demonic would be that which embodies the big lie, that which embodies injustice based on greed, and that which is, instead of having love and compassion, has total indifference to the welfare of those that they're inflicting their dominance on. The major media now have chosen to be the mouthpiece and the camouflage for this system that can only be called demonic. The groups here, what we have in common is the fact that the mainstream media simply will not deal with our issues. Now they will say, well, these are just allegations, these are unproved things. But whenever the White House says something that is unproved, just an allegation, you hear about it on the evening news. No, you hear about it within an hour. Unproven allegations that more often than not turn out to be false. So it's not because the allegations are unproved that they don't report them. It's because their corporate owners do not let them report them. The most dramatic recent evidence of this, of course, was the appearance of the first of the Downing Street memos, because many people said, aha, here is the smoking gun. This is absolute proof about what people have been debating for over a year now. Did we cook the intelligence? So surely this is going to be a 4-inch headline that's going to dominate the news for weeks. What we got was absolute silence until people like Ray McGovern, who's here today, and others started forcing the issue into the public consciousness. Now, of all the issues that are represented here, I happen to be very interested in all of them. I am publicly identified with the issue of 9/11, and I will continue to focus on it, not because just in itself it's the most horrible thing that's ever happened. I mean, when we look at the things that have happened in human history, as far as what happened on that day, we lost 3,000 people and a few buildings. Compared with lying to go to war in Iraq, it's a fairly small thing in itself. Compared with using so-called depleted uranium to poison Afghanistan and Iraq and then the rest of the planet, that is a huge thing that needs to be stopped. But I focused on 9/11 for two reasons. It has been the pretext for all these other things. The victims of 9/11 are not limited to the 3,000 people killed that day and their family members. The victims of 9/11 include the tens of thousands of people killed in Afghanistan, the hundred-some thousand probably now killed in Iraq, all the victims of DU who are already victims and will be victims for decades to come. These are all victims of 9/11. And then there's another reason why I focus on 9/11. The American people have proved to be amazingly tolerant. They have not gotten terribly upset about the fact that they were deliberately lied to go to war in Iraq. They are tolerant of a number of other horrible things that they have learned about. There is one thing they will not tolerate. If the truth about 9/11 is revealed, that will bring this administration down. And more than that, it will reveal the values on which this American global domination project is built.
That was Professor of Theology David Ray Griffin of Claremont College, author of two books critical of the official story of 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor, and The 9/11 Commission, Omissions and Distortions. He spoke at a rally on July 23rd in Washington as part of a weekend of events highlighting the connections between government deception surrounding the events of 9/11 and the lies and false pretexts designed to sell the public on the invasion of Iraq, which were revealed in the Downing Street memos. These deceptions all aimed at moving forward the project of global domination about which Professor Griffin spoke. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary, and this week on the program we're going to delve into those connections with material from a variety of sources. We'll have more testimony from the July 22nd Capitol Hill briefing, sponsored by Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, on the 9/11 Commission's failure to present the truth to the public, and we'll hear from a diplomat who resigned in protest over the invasion of Iraq. First, in a victory for the anti-war movement in central New York, on August 1st, the Binghamton City Council passed the Support Our Troops, Bring Them Home Now resolution by a 5-4 vote. In a nail-biting conclusion, Council President Ed Collins, the swing vote, sent the chamber into an uproar when he uttered "aye" at the tail end of the vote tally. This made Binghamton the first city in New York State to pass a resolution calling for the speedy withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Besides the statewide revolt in Vermont, where 48 cities and towns passed resolutions in opposition to the continued occupation, only three other U.S. cities have passed similar resolutions dealing specifically with troop withdrawal. These are Amherst, Massachusetts, Arcata, California, and San Francisco, now joined by Binghamton. On July 23rd, hundreds of educational events were held across the nation on the Downing Street memos, a series of leaked secret documents from the UK that reported on discussions at the highest levels of the Blair and Bush administrations on plans to manufacture a pretext to launch an invasion of Iraq long desired by the Bush-Cheney administration. Former U.S. diplomat Colonel Anne Wright spoke in Houston, Texas at a teach-in that was part of that nationwide effort. Wally James of KPFT-FM in Houston gives the introduction.
She's a former deputy ambassador to Mongolia. She resigned on the eve of the war with Iraq. In her letter of resignation to Secretary of State Colin Powell, she wrote that this is the only time in my many years of service serving America that I feel that I cannot represent the politics of an administration of the United States. As well as having been an ambassador, she also served in the U.S. Army and in the Army Reserve for a total of 29 years. One clarification, when she comes out, she's taking pictures of the audience, and then she comments on that.
Well, thank you so much. I just wanted to get your pictures because, like me, you can be in the FBI files, too. Because now, I mean, did you see in the paper the other day? I mean, the FBI taking these folders, taking names for people that are in peace action groups. What do we have? What's going on in our country? Well, we got to be speaking out on what's happening in our country. And I am so pleased to know that this many people in Houston, Texas, on such short notice, took time out on a Saturday afternoon in the blazing heat of Houston to come here and talk about some very, very important things for us and our future. As Pokey said, I've been a U.S. bureaucrat, a federal bureaucrat for a long, long time, 35 years and 7 different administrations. And probably many of you are thinking, my God, why did it take her that long to resign? I mean, considering all of the policies that we've had over the years, and I mean some pretty contentious ones that many of you were standing out on the streets and were speaking out and saying the United States should not be doing some things that we were doing. And I, as a bureaucrat, held my nose to things that I knew I didn't want to be associated with. But like so many bureaucrats, so many government employees, we think that we can work within the system, that indeed that we have to work within the system to try to moderate, ameliorate some of the extreme policies that occur in virtually every administration. This particular administration, though, to me, on so many policies, was so over the top, over the line, that finally, even me, after all of my military career and all of my foreign service career, that I said, I cannot have this on my conscience. I cannot have a war in Iraq on my karma. So, thank you. So I took the step, along with 2 others in the diplomatic corps, of resigning from the diplomatic corps. I was the 3rd of the diplomats to resign. Before I resigned, though, I wrote a letter of dissent to Colin Powell. It's a channel that we have in the State Department where a person in an embassy, a far-flung embassy, and I was at the time in Mongolia, and that's about as far-flung as you can get. And so I wrote my concerns about several Bush policies to Secretary of State Colin Powell. I said that I did not feel the United States should be going to war in Iraq without a Security Council resolution. I said that the administration had no policy on North Korea other than just studying it, and with the North Koreans sending missiles over Japan, accosting vessels at sea, we ought to have a policy. We ought to be talking to the North Koreans about what was happening. I also said that the unbalanced policies that we've had in Israel and Palestine was something that the administration had to be working on. And at the time, the Bush administration was doing nothing and still is not doing much. And the 4th thing was my concern about the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties under the Patriot Act. Well, other than that, I thought the administration was just doing fine. Yeah. Well, those are the reasons that I decided to resign. And for the last 2 years, I have, along with many, many others, many of whom that you've seen on this documentary, Uncovered the Truth About the War in Iraq, we've been speaking on from the basis of our long service in the government. many of the people that you see in the documentary Uncovered have extensive service in our intelligence services, in the CIA, in the Defense Intelligence Agency, in the National Security Agency. There are people that have been ambassadors in the Middle East. It's an extensive array of experience that's here. And this documentary has been out since October of 2003, and it's been seen by a lot of people, and it was the first of the documentaries to really talk about the fixing of intelligence. And we talk, where have we heard this term fixing recently? Well, it's the reason that we're here. This is the second anniversary of the Downing Street memos. And as Bill said, we joined many people, thousands, tens of thousands of people all over our country, and I suspect all over the world, who are meeting tonight in protest of what our government has done, a protest of lies, of untruths that we were told about the rationale for going to war. And many of you who have been peace activists for many, many years, it doesn't matter what the rationale is, you good people stand up to say, war is never the answer. That you've got to go for peace, that we've got to have dialogue, that there should be no reason in today's world, in our enlightened world, with all of us that have had education, that all of us who have, we hope individually, a sense of conscience, that why in the world do we allow governments to take implements and kill other people? So these are the reasons that we're here. And you that have been a part of the peace action community, I admire you very much. I've sat on the other side of the table from you for many, many years. In fact, in Nicaragua back in the 80s, I was with the U.S. Embassy there, and I met with many people who from America were coming down to witness what was going on in Nicaragua with the Contras. So I admire what you've stood for and what we all now have to stand for, and what we have to stand for, not standing or sitting in here, but we've got to take to the streets. We've got to get out so that our voices are heard, that our presence is known, that in Houston, Texas, that every Friday or every Thursday or whatever it is, I mean, do you all have here in Houston a weekly peace march or a peace protest? Do you have one at the federal building or at the recruiting station or nothing like that? Well, it's high time. Okay, so how about this Friday in front of the federal building with your signs that you just make at home? We need to get in every city of America people out on the streets to say, we want this policy of war in Iraq to stop. So I would urge you, by the time we leave tonight, let's get settled on what night you all are going to be out there, because it really is important. In Honolulu right now, we've had a vigil that's every Friday afternoon, and I must say it's not well attended, except by 10 people who for the last 3 years have every Friday night been out there. And I'll tell you, I've joined them the times that I've been in Hawaii, and it is really heartening. You don't get the middle finger anymore, like the guys and gals who were out there in the early days of the war. Here you have in Hawaii, one of the most militarized places on this planet, where on the island of Oahu, you have four major military bases. You've got the Navy at Pearl Harbor. You've got the Air Force at Hickam Air Force Base. You've got the Marines at Kaneohe, and you have the 25th Infantry Division up at Schofield Barracks. It's one of the, it's the defense industry provides so much employment in Hawaii. But now you don't get protests from cars that are coming by. They are now seeing the reality of so many people returning, tragically in caskets, tragically without limbs, tragically without minds. They've seen the pictures, although not too many of them on our American TV, of what's happened to the Iraqis. The tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that have been killed. And been killed by a government, ours, and another government, the British, that led a coalition of the willing with fixed intelligence. with information that, I mean, the British, by these Downing Street memos, the British from the very beginning in March of 2002 were questioning what are the Americans talking about? And in dinners that were had with Condoleezza Rice, with Rumsfeld, with Wolfowitz, where our government officials were saying, we're going to war in Iraq no matter what. And the Brits went back to London and said, they have no rationale for this, no legal rationale for going to war. And in fact, the Attorney General of Great Britain steadfastly for 2 years kept saying, there is no legal basis, no legal justification to go to war in Iraq. He changed his mind on the 7th of March of 2003, a mere 2 weeks before the invasion of Iraq. And why do you think he changed his mind? When before he was steadfastly saying, solidly saying, no rationale for it. Well, he wanted to keep his job. Other people, though, said, I'm not putting up with this. I will not have my name associated with this. And in fact, a month ago, I was in London, and I met with a woman just about my age who, too, had spent 30 years in service to her country as an attorney for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, their equivalent of the State Department. She was the deputy legal counsel of the FCO, and she resigned in March of 2003, just like I did, because she said what was going to happen was a war of aggression. And a war of aggression is a war crime. And she, in her legal opinion, her legal advice that had steadfastly held for 2 years, was then pushed aside by the Attorney General. In her letter of resignation, which was she did not make public, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to go talk to her. Why didn't you make this public? She said, well, in contrast to the way you all do things in America, which resign and get that resignation letter out there so people can read it and get a feel of why you felt so strongly that you had to resign. She said, in our diplomatic corps, we resign and then we keep quiet. And so her letter of resignation did not even come public for a couple of months until finally a journalist asked, we would like to have this letter of resignation that the deputy legal counsel gave. Well, the letter came out, but there was one big black mark through the last paragraph of it. And for 2 years, nobody knew what was there until just in March of this year, when finally it was leaked. And the last part of it was about the Attorney General changing his mind, changing his view, despite all the legal advice that he had been giving to the British government about how going to war on the rationale that we had was illegal. So that person representing the UK, and let's see, were there other people in the UK that resigned? Yeah. There were more people in the British government that resigned than in our government did. The former foreign minister or foreign secretary, Robin Cook, resigned. And he was a member of the parliament at the time. Their equivalent to their head of their Agency for International Development, Claire Short, resigned. There were 6 members of parliament that resigned. But do we hear much about that? No, we really don't. And in fact, we didn't really hear all that much about those of us in the diplomatic corps that resigned. Brady Keesling, the first person that resigned, got quite a bit of publicity. But when John Brown and myself resigned, not much at all. Have we heard much about the resignations from the federal government? In the United States, or the retirements, I should say, the retirements. No. No. Well, if you ask around, if you've got friends in the intelligence community, there are hundreds of people who have now retired, who are not putting up or not staying with the government. It is, in some agencies, it's almost to the point. I mean, it's scary because as when I resigned, over 400 people in the federal government emailed me to say, we're sorry you're leaving the diplomatic corps, but we're so glad that you decided to stand up and say, I'm not participating in this. 400 people sent me emails saying, telling about what was happening and where they were assigned in various parts of the world, the anti-American feeling that was coming about because of the policies of the Bush administration. And but one of the things that virtually all of them said was, I wish I could resign, but I can't. I've got kids in college. I've got this. I've got that. And then the rationale that they used that was most meaningful to them was that, indeed, if everybody resigned that was imposed to these policies, then it would leave the field wide open for a complete packing of every institution with political appointees. So I have to give them that in terms that at least they have, I hope, I know they've tried it in their own bureaucratic way to moderate the policies of the Bush administration. However, I must say they have not been successful because the administration has just been hell-bent to leather for going ahead with everything, every program that they've had in their minds for the last 10 years. So to the federal employees that are still there, now my request to them is, join with the bureaucrats in the UK who have turned the UK government into a sieve. A sieve because everything is leaking out of it. I mean, you have these Downing Street memos, 6 extraordinarily important memos that have opened our view of what was going on back in 2000 and 2003 from the British point of view, which was very critical of what the U.S. government was doing. And in fact, when you read these things, it's like, gee, manee. I mean, why in the world would Tony Blair go against the advice of what he was getting in these memos? I mean, they were saying that the United States had no, first it met none of the criteria for action, for military action. I mean, right now, if there's an imminent threat, if there is need for immediate humanitarian assistance, or if there's a UN Security Council resolution, those are the 3 criteria by which you can go to war, according to the British interpretations of law. And I think when you look at the numbers of people or lawyers within our own federal government, our federal government until the Bush administration had agreed with that. So you have these memos that are saying the war was illegal. If they go to war, they don't even have a plan for what's going to happen after they go in. And as we've seen, the tremendous, tremendous problems that have occurred. I mean, I, as a military person, 29 years I spent in the military, and most of the time was in special operations areas, particularly in the civil affairs, the civic action, humanitarian assistance side of it. And that's the part. And I think you all here in Texas have like 4 civil affairs units. They're the ones that go in after combat, and if there's the need for the reconstruction of a government or reestablishment of a government, those are the people that go in on behalf of the United States to quickly put into place some structures that can get a society back moving. Well, there was no plan. There was no plan. As we've seen, the enormous destruction that happened, and now here we are 2 years later. What are the statistics on how many people in Iraq have water? How many have electricity? How are the sewers going? I mean, it's tragic. It is terrible. And it is a reason why there are unnecessary deaths that are occurring on our conscience. I mean, first going to war was bad enough, but I mean, if you'd go ahead and do it, I mean, there are professionals in our military that know how to work in a society after there's conflict. And before this, whatever you want to call it, insurgency, before the real fighting began against the U.S., there was an opportunity, a window of time, that we needed to get busy to reconstruct some things, and it didn't happen because there was no plan. And in fact, if you look at what the former chief of staff of the Army, General Shinseki, Eric Shinseki, was saying before the war started, a year before, the operations plans are bad, that they're lacking 200,000 people that you'll need to have if you're going into an area that large. So the whole plan was bad from the beginning, and why the British went along with this bad, bad plan. My heart bleeds for the British public, who too were deceived. Although I'll say, you know, there were a lot of Brits that were out on the streets. They were having huge, huge protests. And in fact, one of the tragedies of all of this is how our media has let us down. That our media has not let us know what things were going on all over the world, because there were massive protests. And here in America, I mean, I've spoken a lot in the last 2 years, and I've spoken to big crowds like this, small crowds, even larger crowds. But you never hear about these as a nationwide coalition of millions of people that are so upset and so irate about what has happened in our name, that what our government has done. So to the extent that you can continue, because I know it's the people that are in this room, you are the activists, you are the ones that take time out of your lives to call up the press, to call up the Houston Chronicle, or write a letter, email a letter to them. I mean, the things that get in the paper, to the extent that they do, are because people like you take the time to keep pushing on this. So I encourage every group I talk to, don't give up. Keep pushing, because it's just, we've got to take our press back, and they've got to be responsive. Let me just highlight a few things on these memos that we're talking about tonight. A couple of things that have just been... I mean, they have just ripped my heart apart. When you have your own Secretary of Defense who is talking to the British government back in 2002 and saying, we are going to ramp up the level of activity in Iraq in these no-fly zones. We're going to have spikes of activity. Spikes of activity. And what does that mean? That means that we are going to be bombing the Iraqis. We're going to try to provoke them to retaliate against us. So that will be the rationale for us going to war against them. And indeed, when you look at the statistics, the ramp up went up 50%, 100%. And what were they doing? They were bombing, they say, you know, military targets. Only military targets that were actively looking at the... can you say it's an illegal no-fly zone when, indeed, it wasn't the Security Council that even authorized the no-fly zones? They supposedly were for humanitarian purposes to make sure Saddam didn't go after the Kurds and the Shia. But what really happened after Gulf War I? It was we were using that as a way to take out whatever we wanted to. And we took out a lot of innocent Iraqi civilians. So what Rumsfeld was proposing is we're going to ramp that up even further. We're going to ramp it up even further than the 400,000 military flights that were taken over Iraq in that 10-year period of the no-fly zones. Did you know we had 400,000 military missions over Iraq? All you have to do is look in the testimony of the Chief of Staff of the Air Force when he was justifying the U.S. Air Force's budget. And very proudly, he said, yes, we had, I think it was 391,000. To me, that's close enough for 400,000 flights that we had over Iraq. But we're going to bump them up because we want Saddam to retaliate, and then we'll go after him. Provocations for a war of aggression. Now, these are things, these are the facts that are being kept from us, and facts that indeed are the lies that we've been told, the lies and untruths of what has been happening in Iraq. The difficulties now that we have of finding out today what's happening in Iraq. I mean, how many of you all have seen the films on Fallujah? A couple. Okay. There are a couple of documentaries that are out now that everybody ought to see. I mean, what the United States did in Fallujah is knock down an entire city. Knock it down, going after specific people in it, but first cordon it off, try to get as many civilians out as you can, but have no place for them to go. And then you go through it street by street by street, knocking down the buildings. I sat flying from Hawaii one time. I was seated next to a big, big kid. And he was of the age that I thought, this kid is in the military. Well, the guy put on his shades, he put on his hearing devices, and for 8 hours he didn't say a word. When we finally, though, were landing in Chicago, he took everything off, you know, getting ready. I said, well, do you live in Hawaii? No, I don't, ma'am. Well, where do you live? Well, I don't live anywhere now. Well, why were you in Hawaii? Well, I was talking to my friends to keep them alive. I said, well, are you in the military by chance? And he said, yes, I'm a Marine. I said, well, where did you come from? He said, I've just come back from Fallujah. I said, well, I didn't say anything about my background. I'm just an interested citizen sitting next to the guy. I said, well, what was it like there? And he said, it was hell. It was hell. He said, we didn't leave anything standing. He said, it was really nasty. He said, we killed lots and lots of Iraqis that didn't need to be killed. He said, we're all sick from it. I said, what do you mean sick? He said, well, sick in my mind, but sick in my body too. He said, there's so much dust, there's so much stuff in the air because we crushed all those buildings that lots of Marines have been medevaced, taken out by for medical reasons, because any time there was a cut in your arm or anywhere, the dust and the dirt and the grime got in there, and it was an infection like no infections we've ever seen, that our infections would just grow in welts, that they couldn't take care of us, and they've had to medevac us to Germany and back to the States. I said, well, what do you think it was? Well, it was dirt, it was grime, it was all that. And I said, you know, being a little bit up on this, I said, well, you know, were there a lot of shells, artillery shells being used? Yeah, there were. I said, well, did anybody talk to you about depleted uranium in those shells? And he said, well, they tell us that depleted uranium doesn't hurt us at all. Yeah. So, right. Yeah, so here is this big guy who was coming back. Just a civilian, an old lady civilian sitting next to him. Here he said, you know, I'm messed up in my mind. And when you see the statistics now that even the military is putting out, that in surveys that they do as people are departing Iraq, I mean, this is something brand new for the military. When I was in the military, there is no way in the world that, well, how many of you all are Vietnam veterans? A couple of you. Well, I doubt if when you left Vietnam, the Army gave you a little brochure saying, are you having problems coping with what happened, what you saw or what you did? And can we be of assistance to you to help you get through this? Well, no. And as we know by the tragedy that's happened to so many Vietnam vets, that they were not given proper treatment, that they've been on their own for so long, that it's only now that people are acknowledging that Agent Orange was a terrible illness now that so many people have. Well, to the extent, and I think the only reason now that the military is surveying people that are coming back from Iraq is that the veteran system is being so overwhelmed with people that are coming in with psychological problems and trying to cope with what they've done and what they're seeing. Because quite honestly, what they've been through in Iraq, the intensity that virtually everybody that in Iraq has had around them, no matter where they are, even in the green zone. I mean, we're finding that we're having a huge number of people. Like 38% of the people that are coming out of Iraq are acknowledging that they have emotional problems from what they've been through. And in a military service where you don't say anything, you don't acknowledge that you're having any trouble coping, for that number of people to be coming forward to say, I am having difficulty, that means we have a real, real struggle on our hands. That the one thing I am proud of our Congress on is that they push back the Bush administration on the veterans budget that indeed they demanded. They put in another $1 billion, and then I think it's going to go up to another billion, because the Veterans Administration cannot cope with what's happening right now. I was asked in Hawaii in March to be a speaker at Schofield Barracks, the home of the 25th Infantry Division, to be a speaker for Women's History Month. Well, when the sergeant called me up to say, "Ma'am, we understand you've been in the military. Were you in the Women's Army Corps?" So I knew he was trying to get, you know, he wanted a historical perspective on this, because the Women's Army Corps hadn't been in existence in over 20 years. And so I said, "Yes, I've been in the Women's Army Corps." And he said, "Would you like to speak to us at Women's History Month?" I said, "Well, yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to. Ooh." But I said, "Sergeant, do you know that I was in the Diplomatic Corps too?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." And I said, "Well, did you know that I resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." I said, "Wow. Hmm." I said, "Well, does your colonel know?" Because I didn't want that sergeant getting in trouble. And he said, "Yes, ma'am, he does." I said, "Well, hmm, does your general know?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am, he does." I said, "Well, count me in. I'll be there. I'll be there with bells on." So I spoke, and my topic was, don't lose your humanity. Because it's not the Army's fault. It's not the military's fault. They are where they are. They serve whatever administration we, well, maybe not us, but the American public elects or is selected or... Yeah, I'm really confused about political science these days. It just doesn't make much sense. But anyway, the military does whatever the person who's been confirmed by the Congress, voted in, sworn in, whatever it is, they do what they're supposed to do. So I wasn't going to take it out on my old Army guys and gals, because they're doing what they're ordered to do. Even though, if you really look at it, there are people within the military that are, in their own way, couching what they say, but you can see that there are splits in the military. When you have four judge advocate generals of the four major military services that are telling the Bush administration that its policy on enemy combatants is wrong, that you need to apply the Geneva Conventions to anyone that's picked up on a battlefield, when you get people like that standing up, you know the military is trying to signal to us that they aren't just solidly behind this. Well, anyway, so I thought I'd give this military a real chance to, you know, hear what I had to say. So I talked about don't lose your humanity, that indeed you have choices when you go onto that battlefield. And sometimes the choices are not very good, but you have to live with yourself the rest of your life, and you better, for your own psyche, make the right choice. And sometimes those choices on the battlefield may get you in trouble with your sergeant and your lieutenant. But who are you going to live with, yourself or those people? Well, so I gave my spiel, and it was, I must say, there was not a rising up of the audience in applause, but nobody walked out. Of course, there were a lot of sergeants sitting around, so the privates couldn't. But I think it was the privates that would not have walked out. It would have been the sergeants if they could have. But I don't think they would have wanted to. The other person that spoke on that podium was a two-star general, a woman, airborne qualified, the head of Tripler Army Medical Center. And when we sat down first in the audience before we were introduced, she said, "Oh, I haven't met you, Ann. I'll read your bio real fast." And I said, "Well, you don't have to read it too fast. I'll just point out the one little phrase in there that you'll probably be very interested in, that I resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq." And she went, oh, yes. "Well," I said, "I'd also like to mention that one thing I will be talking about in my speech is that all of these people that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, that I know that you, as the head of the medical system in Hawaii are going to be doing everything you possibly can to help them with their emotional and their physical problems. But that I feel that you don't have all the answers and you don't have all the resources you need. And I'll be mentioning a lot of organizations that have stood solidly with veterans over time, and that these young men and women that are in these audience need to know about. The Veterans for Peace, the ACLU, the Friends Service Committee, the GI Hotline, that there are a lot of organizations that are there that want to work. The Iraqi Veterans Against the War, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. There's a lot of experience that's out there that your young men and women need to know about. And she looked at me square in the face and she said, I'm so glad you're mentioning that. So there's a lot of people in all areas of our government that are very distressed about what's going on. But they can't speak out. Those military people can't speak out. They get court-martialed if they do. I had the luxury of resignation. What they're looking for are the people of America to speak out, because you speak out for them. And don't let anybody, none of those guys in Washington and none of those Republicans here in Houston, tell you that that military wants to be where it is. It needs you standing up for it and you to help get them out of Iraq.
We're listening to a speech by Colonel Ann Wright, former deputy ambassador to Mongolia, who resigned on the eve of the war with Iraq in protest. And up next, we're going to have her Q&A. The microphone wasn't able to pick up the people asking the questions. Most of the time, she repeats the questions. The other times, I think you can figure out what she's talking about. Let's go back to that now.
Yes, sir.
What is the best thing we can do?
Okay, the question, and I'll repeat the question so that we can get them on the tape. The question is, as the gentleman was saying, having big protests in the offices of your congressional delegation, sometimes that you don't feel are really being listened to, are there other things that you can be doing? Well, first, I applaud you. I think you ought to have a daily sit-in in Tom DeLay's office. Honest to God, I think you ought to drop a list, and you ought to have somebody, or at least 10 people, every single day be sitting in his office on something, because you got plenty of things to sit in there on. And then when you get tired of sitting in his office, I want you to get a cheap ticket to Washington. Because do you know that we do not have a vigil in front of the White House as an anti-war vigil? No. Most days there is not one anti-war sign out there. Do you know who the only people are that are sitting out there? For 24 years there have been two people that are doing an anti-nuke protest. And they said, we'll be glad to keep your anti-war signs. In fact, they've got them stacked under their stuff so that if any of you all show up, you can go there and you can get a sign that's sitting there waiting for you. But what we need, I mean, can you believe it? We do not have in the White House every single day good, solid Americans like us out there protesting. In contrast to the Brits, right in front of Parliament Square for the last 3 years, they have had a permanent, one block long, array of posters and placards and banners. I know, but we need to do it. It's good for your conscience. It's good for your soul to get out and do these things. And whether or not you think it's doing anything on really changing the policy, in one way, that doesn't matter, because what it is doing for you is that you're doing something and you're getting rid of a little frustration and you're contacting other people that are just as frustrated and you're getting out and doing something. And you never can tell how this momentum will start rolling. So what little you can do or what great things you can do, just keep doing them. And if you aren't doing them now, start. Okay?
What do you think of that anyway?
Well, the whole issue of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and the types of interrogations that are going on, I think our military has been ill-served by our politicians, who certainly gave them, if not the directives on how they interrogate, at least the environment around where some people in the military and the CIA and contract interrogators have taken liberties that will haunt us for the rest of our lives. That the things that have been done, and, you know, for Abu Ghraib, we only know of 29, you and I have only seen 29 of over 1,500 photos that are available. And in fact, in the paper today in your Houston Chronicle, it said that in a federal court judge is hearing again the rationale of why the Defense Department now says that these photos have to be classified. I myself have three congressmen and women who have put in Freedom of Information Act requests for those photos. Not that I really want to see them, but what I want to do, I want to count out the number of legs, the number of people that are in each one of these. Because one of the interesting things is that of the people that have been prosecuted for abuses in Abu Ghraib, virtually all of them are reservists. They're all from one reserve unit in Maryland. A disproportionate of them number are women. You have three women out of the original seven. If you look at the statistics of the number of people that are in that unit, it isn't 50% of them. But if you look at the number of interrogators and military police that have been in those prisons, the number of reservists, well, actually now it's getting very, very high. At the time it wasn't. But now that virtually every reserve military police unit and intelligence unit has been called up. But at the time that these abuses happened, the active army, tragically, has a lot of culpability on this. And they have not been held accountable because essentially nobody of the rank, above the rank of sergeant, has been held accountable for anything. So these are some of the things that we need to be very watchful of. Yes, sir.
I'm no longer in office.
The question is there an alternative? Can we get out of this mess with Bush and Cheney still in office, or will it take turning them out of office? If they were willing to eat crow and to acknowledge their mistakes, and then it is possible with them in office. But I, as you all, don't believe that they are willing to acknowledge that they told us untruths to start with, that they went ahead and created military plans that were poorly done and allowed a situation to get totally out of control. So with that, I say that with the untruths and lies, that the American public really does need to evaluate whether or not those people should stay in office, and whether or not, certainly for the president, there are certain avenues available to include impeachment, and for other senior members of an administration, certainly criminal charges, some of which have already been filed by the ACLU. Now, let me just mention one other thing while we're on this. Can we get out of the mess? What if we just back out? What if we say, get the troops out right now? What will that mean? Well, to me, it seems that the cause of the violence is us. We are causing the violence. We are the targets of the violence, and any Iraqi that dares do anything with us then becomes the target too. I think it is very reasonable to assume that if the United States and the British would get out of there, that indeed there will be, I mean, working within the international community, I think there can be a small number of nations that would be amenable to the various factions that are there, that might not be amenable to us, but amenable to the people of Iraq, that can come in and help provide a sense of stability until they can sort out exactly what they want to do. This whole mess of, well, we've still got to train another 500,000 people to be in the military or to be the police or to be that. Well, now let's see. What was happening before we went in there? Did they have some military folks? Yes. Did they have some police? Yes. Were they under a regime that used them in a very bad way? Yes. Kind of like ours. So I think that there is, I mean, when you're looking, comparing Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, the Iraqis were long years ahead in certain ways than the poor people of Afghanistan who had been faced with war for 25 years. The Iraqis had an infrastructure. I mean, you look at Baghdad. It had tall buildings. It had freeways. It had all of this stuff. It doesn't really have them now because we knocked a lot of them down. But it did have a lot of people in the military, trained military, which the administration has been slowly bringing back when after they've realized that they did the wrong thing by totally disbanding the Iraqi military. So I think there is a way that if as long as we're there, this mess will continue. There is no way that it will ever be resolved as long as American military are in there. With them backed out, there is every possibility that something better will happen. It will not be perfect, but I can guarantee you the number of people, the number of lives lost from the Iraqis will go down immensely, and certainly with our troops out, hopefully no more Americans will be killed there. Yes, sir. Well, the resolution of American interests, human interests, I mean, you know, in some of the cartoons it says, how did our oil get under their sand? You know, and if you're looking at it from that, which I think is one of the rationales in Washington, you know, how did our oil get under there? I mean, and if you're looking in that way, and when you have senior leaders of your administration who are deeply involved in the oil trade, and when you have now one of the in and out guys of the Iraqi political scene, Ahmed Chalabi, who was on our good list for DOD, then the bad list for DOD, and now he's the interim oil minister. I mean, what's going on there? So there, you know, there's a lot that'll have to be sorted out. And I'll tell you, my crystal ball is pretty cloudy on how it all will turn out. Other than the fact that as long as there's an American military person in there, it's going to be bloody. Okay, let's see. Yes, sir. Well, good. I'm glad to know this intel network is covering the world. Well, your friends in Hawaii probably told you that at a talk that I gave a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned that I just come back from West Africa, from Sierra Leone. It was the first time I'd been back in 8 years since we left after the tragedy of all the brutality and the cutting and chopping of arms and legs and all of that. In the 8 years, though, that I've been gone, finally the international community put some attention there, and indeed the largest peacekeeping operation, UN peacekeeping operation of this decade, has been in Sierra Leone. 18,000 UN peacekeepers have been there and have kind of calmed the situation down. Calmed it down to the extent that young men and women are now, from Sierra Leone, taking military medical entrance exams. That people from Sierra Leone are now joining the U.S. Army from Sierra Leone. They're going through the defense attaché, taking medical physicals by the doctor that the U.S. Embassy has, and then are being recruited. And I would say that probably in every country of West Africa and East Africa and South Africa that our military attachés are probably making contact. I don't think they've been signed on as recruiters, but they certainly have plenty of information for young men and women who want to be who want to get a green card to come to the United States, although you don't get a green card initially. And in fact, one of the great heroes of our anti-war movement, Camilo Mejia, a young man from Nicaragua, who joined the U.S. military, fought in Iraq once, then went back again and said, I'm not doing this anymore. He was actually in the United States to regularize his immigration status when he finally decided, I've had enough, and he went AWOL, later deserted, and then later came back to say, okay, fine, I'll take my punishment. If punishment is what you want to give me for saying I will never kill another human being, I will not go to an illegal war. And that young man served 9 months in jail. But he's part of although he was recruited here in America, he was already here. But I think if you've got friends in Central and South America, you ought to be inquiring. Ask around how many people are being recruited out of those countries. And certainly the Pacific Islands, There are countries in the Pacific now that have very few men left. The island of Fiji has had a terrible thing happen. You know, the Fijians had lots of men who, from the Fijian military, were a part of UN peacekeeping missions. The Fijians really were some of the most professional of the militaries that signed up for UN peacekeeping duty. So you have a lot of people who've come back from those duties went back home to Fiji to live a nice, peaceful life until the war in Iraq started. And until, because of the great insecurity that we have caused, that everything that happens there has to have security consultants and security personnel to help people move through Baghdad or get out to other places. So they're hiring up and paying big bucks if you're an American or if you're a Brit. You as a private citizen can be hired on by these big security companies and you'll be getting $150,000 to $200,000 for going out there. If you're from Fiji, lots of experience, the recruiters go down there, the civilian companies go down and get these people, these men who have had lots of experience. They don't pay them nearly as much.